Welcome back to the Donald Trump Show, where it's all Trump all the time. Mike, your favorite thing about the Donald?
He's huge.
Huge.
He's the best thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, he's going to find the best people. He doesn't have that answer right now, but he's going to find the best people, and it's going to be so classy. You know, with his mandatory registration for the Muslims, it's going to be so classy.
That is very classy, thing.
It is very classy.
You know what I like best about him? The way he makes the adjective looks sound sarcastic.
gosh.
It's the end of the world as we know.
Yes, it is.
Oh, come on. This is a wonderful period in American history.
Please elaborate.
Well, we're getting a right-wing populace, which, you know, hasn't happened for a while, so that's kind of nice.
It's been a little bit.
I'm dubious about the you're referring to the Vox article. Dubious that he's a right-wing populist. I don't think that populism is a right or left-wing phenomenon. I mean, the populist instinct in American politics is always, give me that, it's mine!
Yes. I think you're right in that here in the United States, populists aren't... They're the embodiment of everything that's wrong in America from both sides of the political aisle. I wouldn't call him right-wing in the sense that we in the U.S. Necessarily use the term. I mean, he's not...
Not an economic.
I
would say that he's a nationalist, and that's something that's typically associated with the right wing in the U.S.
Yes.
That was my thought reading that Vox piece, that the word nationalist just kept jumping in.
Right.
I think we've talked on a previous episode that I'm very dubious when people try to systematize fascism, because to me... As I read the history, fascism was simply any excuse for Benito Mussolini to be in power, any excuse for, for Franco in Spain to be in power. And they would just use whatever explanations happened to make sense at the time. But I can't think of any example where you've had a government that has been termed fascist. So you think of Italy, you think of Argentina, you think of Spain and arguably Germany. None of them ever had a transition of power, right? Because there was no theory behind it, at least as I assess it. It's just about the charismatic all-purpose leader.
I'd argue there is theory behind it. It wasn't necessarily coherent. It didn't really have the chance to develop. But the theory behind it is power. Their theory behind it is power embodied in an individual, generally speaking. So, yeah, it's not, it's very much brutish. There will be no smooth transitions in any sort of truly fascist government, because it's about the embodiment of power within one man. So that one man goes, and then now what?
And that one man against the system. In that same article, I thought it was intriguing that they talked about how people, ordinarily with fascism, there will be a rejection of existing institutions. The system's not working. We need someone who can push past the system and replace the system. I don't know if that applies to Donald Trump, but it actually applies to Obama. If you think back to 2008, this was the entire predicate of his campaign, that people were fed up that the system wasn't working. I wonder if maybe wisdom is perhaps coming late to Ezra Klein and the Vox people at this point. I wonder if looking back, they can now see that maybe there's something a little problematic about what was going on at that time.
Well, you know, there is, once again, you know, fascism and communism, leftism, shares two sides of the same coin. And one of those sides, both sides will reject the existing institutions. Hard leftists will reject existing institutions because they're institutions of oppression. Fascists will reject existing institutions because they're either they've become corrupt, quote-unquote, or they no longer are able to act effectively. But the key difference is that progressives, leftists, will look forward and say, we're going to work on to something new. Whereas fascists, a lot of times, will harken back to an idealized mythical past.
Make Germany great again.
Exactly. Make Germany great again. You know, the Mussolini and his fever dream of reforming the Roman Empire under an Italian military, which is just hilarious. Yeah, so in that sort of sense, I do see a sliver of what could be considered fascist in Donald Trump's argument to make America great again. Also, he seems to be very corporatist, the idea that government and corporations should work hand in hand and the government should support indirect corporations.
He's a bit more principled than he is, I think.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell, his approach to the relationship between business and government is entirely self-serving.
Yes.
But that's kind of how I feel about Mussolini's approach to it, that it's self-serving, and he's very happy to have corporations exercise, the government can work through corporations so long as the corporations don't disagree, and as soon as they disagree, then they must be crushed.
Yes.
Because now they are no longer useful.
Do you see the Donald crushing corporations under his heel if they disagree?
I think as soon as something ceases to be useful to him, then he will not be in favor of it. I was going to suggest when we talk about rejecting institutions, to a certain extent, the right is inoculated against that because of the something approaching reverence for the Constitution. I think it will be very interesting to see the first time that the Constitution unambiguously opposes something that Trump says he wants to do, and how not necessarily his supporters, but what should I say, not necessarily the hardcore Trump supporters, but people like Lauren Graham and Coulter and, you know, established Republican figures who've been entranced by this idea. I wonder at that point, do they wake up? Because people are talking about how his immigration comments are wildly unconstitutional, and I don't think it's at all clear that that's correct. You know, people have the fact that people are so desperate that they are recurring to the no religious tests for public office clause, mm-hmm. suggests that it's not really so much that they think it violates the Constitution so much as they think it surely must. And so let's go and find some kind of proof text that applies. And so I think that's a little. When I say weak, I don't mean in the sense that it's not convincing. It's not convincing to the Trump people.
But yes.
If he wanted to, if he said he wants to, I think he's suggested that the government should shut down parts of the internet and shut out jihadists from that. And that's much more clearly a problem with the First Amendment.
Yes.
And at that point, I don't think that it would be interesting to see whether that reverence inoculation for the Constitution keeps them from saying, oh, yes, the institutions are a problem, or whether they will at that point swap over.
Well, I think this is, you know, this entire thing has been a reassertion of everything that the founders feared. You know, this is the reason why the founders decided to have this thing called the Electoral College in place, to prevent the rabble from sending demagogues to the highest public office in the land. And
so, do you think the Electoral College will stop a Trump presidency?
Not anymore, no.
I don't think that's ever been a... I have a hard time imagining any situation in which the Electoral College would act as a circuit breaker in that way. Every now and again, people have fantasies about that, but I don't really see it happening.
I could see it happening during certain times in our history. During the early days of the Republic, I could see the Electoral College acting as a circuit breaker. In fact, in some ways, I mean, this has happened once or twice in forms of protest votes in the Electoral College. There was, after George Washington's unanimous election by the Electoral College. There was another candidate who ended up getting all of the Electoral College votes, if I remember correctly, but someone voted against him just so George Washington would be the only person who have unanimous. There was a Electoral College official out of West Virginia, I believe it was, who ended up switching sides and casting a protest vote. Not that it mattered.
I think it's much more likely to happen now, actually, than in those days, because there were logistical hurdles other than just individualistic protest votes. If you were the elector or one of the electors for Massachusetts, mm-hmm. you did not necessarily know what had happened in the election in Virginia or Georgia. Nowadays, of course, everyone knows exactly what's going on in the dynamics of the race, and so mm-hmm. I could see it happening in the event of a close and extremely momentous race. Like I could say it's Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, and it's neck and neck, and the Electoral College is going to be very, very close. It's one state makes all the difference, and it all comes down to this one state. And something happens. I could imagine in that situation enormous pressure being brought on someone to change their vote. Whether it would happen or not, I think this gets into the realm of kind of House of Cards, West Wing kind of stuff. Political fantasy rather than the arc of the universe does seem to bend towards boredom and placidity.
Yes,
is placidity a word?
Placidness.
Yeah. I can't think of the.
Yeah,
but the I think I've invoked it before. But the but when I was a teenager and Russia was burning, more or less, there was a cover feature for the paper that my parents got, The Guardian, in their weekend magazine. They had a picture, big picture of Boris Yeltsin, and they had four futures for Russia. And I can't remember exactly. I think one of them was returning to communism. I think one of them was militarism, kind of a fascist kind of takeover. I can't remember what the third one was, but the fourth one, which struck me as obviously not the one that was going to happen, was just muddling through. That it would just knock through and just, it would just somehow work itself out in some kind of way. Nothing dramatic would happen. And obviously, that was just ridiculous. Things don't work that way, except they do, which, and what I've learned in the, 25 years since then is that actually that does seem to be, what normally seems to happen is things go basically the way you expect them to. There is no deus ex machina. Things tend to work out exactly the way they look they're going to work out. The fact that Ted Nugent endorsed McCain did not mean that McCain was suddenly going to take off in the polls. The sole counterexample to that might be the winter storm that hit New York immediately before the 2012 election, which might have changed the course of history by making Obama look presidential just when he needed to. But ordinarily, even back then, it looked pretty clear that Obama was going to win. It just wasn't going to be by as much. So,
yeah, I think that most of the time, an object is going to continue moving the direction that it's moving unless it meets some sort of resistance. And the same thing goes true with politics, the same thing with nations, all that kind of stuff. Multiple things have to fail in order for something dramatic to happen. Things do, there is always that one match that sets off the powder keg. I mean, World War I. There was going to be a war that would engulf Europe, probably somewhere involving the Balkans. Bismarck called it. It was quite obvious, looking back on it now, with all the alliances that was going on. But there was going to be an event that no one could see. The execution, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. That was the match that set everything off. Everything will carry on as normal. Everything will tend towards mediocrity until it doesn't.
Right. Well, but even in that case, you can make the argument that the inertia was, as you said, towards war. It was a powder keg in search of a match.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes that is the direction that things are going. That they're mm-hmm. going. You know, you can. I wonder how in 50 years we'll look back on Turkey shooting down those Russian jets, because it could turn out to be absolutely nothing, or that it could be that was the moment that set us on course for the dissolution of NATO.
Well,
I mean, you refer to the alliances that drove us all into war,
yes.
A century ago, and the irony is we now have exactly the same thing.
I think if something cataclysmic was going to happen out of Turkey shooting down Russian jets, it would have happened already. The fact that it hasn't is a good thing. I'll actually give props to Vladimir Putin for not firebombing Istanbul or trying to seize the city or anything like that. I think that thankfully, we've avoided at least that sort of that powder keg for the moment. But it could definitely happen again.
Before we get to my note about the word cataclysm, we should talk about beer real quick. Otherwise, we're already like 15 minutes in and we haven't...
My question is, Donald Trump somebody you'd like to have a beer with? Because, as we all know, this is a critical question for any presidential candidate.
Well, if I were to have a beer with him, I would be having a Bell's Christmas Ale out of Comstock, Michigan, which is pretty good.
That's really low energy, Simon. There's not enough gold plating on that bottle.
It would be a gold-plated.
If I were to have a beer with Donald Trump, I'd probably have, like, an Irish car bomb beforehand. Donald Trump is I'd love to have a beer with Donald Trump.
It seems like it has to be an act, doesn't it? That you wonder what he's actually like.
No, as far as I can tell, this is not an act for him at all.
I don't know.
People who have told personal stories about him,
mm-hmm.
including a former Playboy writer who interviewed him for a Playboy piece, and just kind of spent the weekend with him.
It's very classy.
He said basically that Donald Trump is pretty much what you would expect in private. He's childish, he's egotistical, he goes on rants, and then he'll turn right around and say the most wonderful things about you, and then turn around again and say that you're a complete idiot and you're terrible and that sort of thing. And it's pretty much what you see in public. He's pretty consistent, apparently.
Yeah, but I'm not having an Irish car bomb today. I'm having an accumulation white India pale ale because I am dreaming of a white Christmas, but it doesn't look like that because it's about, 60 degrees outside?
70.
70 degrees outside, yes.
In December.
It's lovely. I think I'm going to burn some coal later today.
I'm going to go home and hang my Christmas lights.
I'm just going to feel like I'm back in Houston.
Yes, it's definitely brings back memories.
What do you have to drink there?
Well, I've got a hibernation ale from the Great Divide Brewing Company. It is an English-style old ale, and it's pretty good. I really like the flavor balance in it.
Do you guys have any Christmas plans?
Well, I'm going to try more beers with 8.7 alcohol percentages.
Especially
if it's with Donald Trump.
Always a good decision. Drink. Yeah. Well, I'll be moving to Indianapolis, so that's always exciting.
He'll be having a big city Christmas.
Yes.
I think we are actually in Indianapolis for Christmas.
Oh,
because
really?
My sister-in-law is hosting Christmas this year.
Oh, that's nice.
Wonderful.
So we will be up there. But I'm hoping that I'm going to have a Christmas break full of the smell of glue and fiber optics.
Uh-huh.
Because I just ordered I can't remember what the scale is, but it's a quite sizable model of the Galactica. I'm hoping to put some fiber optics in it and make it all pretty and exciting. there was a sail, and I thought, she is a pretty ship. And so I'm not a particularly good model maker, but I'm hoping that I can spruce it up with some fiber optic additions. Speaking of apocalypses, as you know, everyone who fears the Cylon return needs a get-out bag, and the best way to get a bug-out bag is to get a Casper. No, I had a better version of that planned, and it didn't work out, but you get the idea. But I did want to ask, and I brought this up the other week, we had watched Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, and I had some cataclysm questions. And there's one that relates to what you were just saying about Trump and cataclysm.
Mm-hmm.
The questions that I had in my mind were, if there was an inbound asteroid and it was going to hit, would you want to know? If you were advising the president, would you think it wise to tell the population? And if you were the president, that is to say, if you were being advised, if you were the decision maker, would you feel differently if it was your decision to make rather than you were just counseling what the decision ought to be? If that's not too facile a distinction.
That's not a facile distinction. I certainly think that I wouldn't have the same moral authority if I were not the person making the decision on that point. But I think I would err on the side of telling people if it were my call to make.
If you were just a private citizen, would you want to know?
Yeah. I would think that any faithful Catholic would want to know. Those few minutes could be really key.
Yeah. See, as a private citizen, I'd want to know. As a president, I don't think I'd tell people until about 5 minutes before it hits, after I launch all the nukes at it and see if it does anything. You know. It depends upon the size of the asteroid, too. If it's going to be an asteroid that's just going to wipe out both coasts, like if it hits the Atlantic Ocean, if it's just an asteroid that wipes out the eastern seaboard and western Europe, then I might tell people then evacuate those cities, try and save lives. But if it's a planet-destroying asteroid, then I'll try and do everything to move it. But yeah, I'd rather have.
There'll be no one left to impeach you.
Yeah, I'd rather have the week be rather calm, rather than mass chaos and people killing each other and all that good stuff.
See, that would be my fear, that if you tell people, you're going to have pandemonium.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And stupidly looting. Right?
Yes.
You know that that's going to happen, even though there's no good reason why. What's the point? We're all dead in a week.
Hedonism.
But there will still be mass looting. Yes.
Hedonism, yeah.
I do think it does make a difference whether you are merely advising what the decision ought to be versus actually making the decision, that there is a certain weight to that, which is what people who say that they want a Catholic monarch, this is their logic, that when it's a single person who feels accountable before God, then they do not necessarily just act on what they might think to be the wisest course, that they wrestle with it and pray on it and all this kind of stuff, in a way that a committee doesn't. With a committee, there's no responsibility, there's even less responsibility when we're all dead in a week, because, you know, what does it matter if the decision was right or wrong?
Yeah, there's a diffusion of responsibility.
Yeah, when uneasy rests the head on, what was it? Uneasy lies the head on which rests the crown. Is that the phrase?
I don't recall.
Something like that.
Something to that effect. But
and if it's a papal tiara, you might as well just go to the doctor for neck problems right now.
I don't know that they still have one. Wasn't
all the six
was auctioned, right?
Yeah.
Was it auctioned or just stowed?
No, it's in the museum.
Okay.
Yeah, do you really blame him for deciding, I don't want to wear that?
It's classy. It's like super luxe, right? You know, it's very... you know what,
We should auction it to the Donald and give them
a... Yes, I'm surprised that Trump doesn't have it. But you know what, I don't think that as a rule, an unmarried middle-aged man wearing a tiara is ever a good call.
I don't know. If Donald Trump gets a divorce, we may get that. I mean, it wouldn't be his first time. Or his second.
Oh, with the divorce, or with, I thought you meant
the
tiara.
With the tiara.
Or his third, probably. I don't know.
He's going to take his tiara and go home. He may actually apparently leave and go run third party, which, you know.
Well, I think that could be good.
Here's my thought on the broker.
It could be very good for the Republican Party if he leaves and runs third party. Let's put it that way.
I think it'd be terrible. You know, you would have the people who are supporting him, the diehard supporters, many of whom weren't going to vote Republican in the first place, but he'd certainly attract a few percent. And a few percent is all it takes in key states. I actually think that our best hope of getting out of this mess, unless he pulls a Howard Dean and craters on impact, which is your theory.
Mm-hmm.
But if he doesn't explode on impact with the first votes, and if he is still in the race going down the road, I think our best outcome is the brokered convention scenario that came out in the news yesterday. Because then no one can say he didn't have a fair shake. He got to the convention. It was, say it split 60-30-30.
Mm-hmm.
Either the two 30s do a deal or one of the 30s does a deal with him. And then no one can say that he didn't get a fair go of it. Although I yesterday had a conversation with someone who was complaining that then people would feel disenfranchised. I said, no, you're using the word disenfranchised the way that the Democrats use it. You're not disenfranchised, you just lost.
Yeah.
You cast a vote and it didn't work out. That doesn't mean you were disenfranchised. You had your chance to have your say, and it didn't work out.
Yep.
Yeah, if disenfranchised just means that your vote never results in your candidate getting elected, then I've been disenfranchised in every single election.
Yeah, that's not what it means. There are so many words in our political discourse that get used to mean things that they don't mean. People will talk about, I was just reading an article that I think Garrett Epps wrote for The Atlantic about Fisher 2, the return of Abigail Fisher to the Supreme Court. And he says that Texas is, of course, very segregated. No, it's not segregated. It's not segregation if people just live in different places. That's not what the word means. And I really think that when people refer to Bush or Obama as a fascist, or to America today as an apartheid state or segregated, it just suggests that these people have no idea what the actual historical reality of what they are referring to by analogy actually was like. If they thought that all that segregation meant was that, you know, Mr. Smith lives on one side of the street and Mr. Jones lives on the other side of the street, and they just chose to use different water fountains, that's not what it was.
Some of the people think that, and I can forgive those, but there are people out there who know very good and well what those terms actually mean, and intentionally abuse the language emotionally. It's very unfortunate how we dilute the language that way, because for a while it has its emotional effect, but that passes. I mean, you know,
ultimately, you trivialize the very thing you're seeking to lionize.
Racism is a good example of that. The word the charge of racism no longer has any real impact after 8 years of everyone saying that you're a racist if you disagree with the president.
Yeah, it's now a punchline. It's a joke. Mm-hmm. And that's very unfortunate.
Yeah. I wanted to get to, I mean, we talked about the cataclysmic piece in a couple of different contexts, but I wanted to come back to that. There was a Jonah Goldberg piece that circulated yesterday. I don't know if you probably didn't see that, but I think now you subscribe to his email list.
Yes.
That dealt with this idea of we can't do X because Y wants us to do X.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that this is not actually a very serious idea, but it's become pervasive. And he raises this question of, well, look, if ISIS wants to meet us in a cataclysmic battle, that's what triggered my memory of this piece, at Raqqa, I think it is.
Yeah.
If they want to have that cataclysmic... I'm sorry?
It's Tabiq.
Thank you. If they want to have this cataclysmic, all right, flies down, decks out, we're going to have a full-on military confrontation, let's do it. Why not? They lose that battle. What's the argument against doing that? And I thought that was a pretty good piece. And I wondered if you guys had any reaction to that. I know you haven't read the piece, but you get the idea. It's not a complicated idea.
Before.
Yeah.
It is what they want. But the problem is that even if they lose that battle, they win. Part of their strategy is to goad the West into making decisions like that precisely because it does their recruitment for them.
I suppose the argument there would be, well, listen, our theory says that there will be a cataclysmic battle at Dubik, and there was a cataclysmic battle at Dubik, therefore we were correct. But does that play if at said battle they were absolutely hammered?
It works pretty well if you have just a basic level of confirmation bias. I mean, if you believe that at Dubik you'll have the final battle, and on that field, you'll be saved in a very literal deus ex machina kind of sense, then you're going to believe that no matter how many battles you lose at Dubik, you're going to keep believing that. That's not a negotiable belief. There's no empirical test for that belief. You're going to keep believing that no matter how many times you lose.
So you may have lost the first battle of Dubik, but we'll be back for Dubik 2.
Yeah.
Dubik 3, Dubik harder. Dubik 4, live Dubik or Dubik hard.
Dubik 5, the Dubikening. Yes. There's a slightly more sophisticated version of the argument which says their intention is to drain us financially. And that's an interesting kind of spin on that, saying we go in, we're stuck in a quagmire, we're drained financially. Frankly, I think that militarily we can go in, we can wreck the place, and not have our economy devastated.
Indeed. In fact, if we invite a lot of refugees in, it might really help our economy.
Yeah. A lot of people to work at convenience stores and then end up going and their children becoming doctors. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
But I think that the key piece to the Jonah Goldberg article that I liked said, it doesn't mean that we should go to Dubik, but it's not saying that we shouldn't either.
We shouldn't exclude it a priori simply because that's what they want.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I agree with that. I think the idea that the other side wants us to do this is not a counter-argument against doing this. And I think it's actually really damaging to American politics that we think it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it is useful information. If Hitler wants us to bomb Dresden, then I think that gives us pause, and we think, well, hang on, well, why does he want us to do that? Are we sure we want that? This is a good idea, and so it is a relevant point, but it's not a point that overrides and excludes an option a priori.
You know, it has the supporters of a group like ISIS. There's the core believers. There's the people who are coming in from elsewhere. But there's also the tribal factions on the ground. And these
tribes for hire.
Yeah. These tribal factions aren't supporting ISIS because they're necessarily believers in the apocalyptic ideology. They're supporting ISIS because they believe that ISIS is winning. And if ISIS loses, if they're on the losing side of it, they're starting to lose ground, then those loyalties flip. Those loyalties flip. ISIS no longer has a base to operate out of. And unlike Al-Qaeda, which at its core can operate without land, ISIS can't operate without land. It can't go back on the claims that it has made. If the caliphate loses land, then it's no longer a caliphate. And that will erode at its ability to have loyalty of all of these groups that it's having loyalty to. I think our smartest move would be to go in and deprive them of their land as quickly as possible. And if we did that, then, you know, all of these other, right now they have loyalty out of Libya, they have loyalty from Boko Haram in Nigeria. All of those loyalty oaths will fade if they lose their land.
You deprive them of the ability to make the argument that in the Atlantic piece you've mentioned several times in previous episodes, the Atlantic piece on what ISIS wants. In that article, if memory serves, they talk about how ISIS is able to make the claim that if a caliphate exists, all Muslims must adhere to it and support it and mm-hmm. go there and assist with it and all that kind of stuff. That's not to suggest that that is actually a religious duty of Muslims, but that's the claim that they make. And they are only able to make that claim because they, in fact, control territory, which mm-hmm. I think is your point. So if you deprive them of territory, you deprive them of the capacity to make the claim, at least with a straight face, that they are a caliphate, and therefore deprive them of the whatever draw they think that that has. And whether it does or does not, I don't know. I don't know to what extent there really is sort of a significant number of people going to Syria to fight. I know that we hear about high-profile cases, but I haven't seen any concrete numbers on it, and I suppose that those numbers couldn't exist.
Well, it's an interesting thing because they're starting to tell people not to go to Syria. At least last I checked, they were telling people, if you can't go to Syria, do what you can where you are mm-hmm. in the name of the caliphate, in the name of ISIS, a.k.a. the Paris attacks,
and San Bernardino.
A.k.a. San Bernardino. And this, especially the San Bernardino attacks, really shaped my thinking on this. This is no longer a terroristic jihad necessarily. This is like what they had in Palestine. The idea that it doesn't matter who you are, what you can do, all you can do is throw rocks. Then go outside and beam the other side over the head and knock them unconscious and kill them that way. If you have knives, go out and stab someone. And that's what we have a global version of that. The other day in London, outside of a subway station, outside of the Tube in London, someone just started stabbing people. And this has been terrorist linked.
Interestingly, the video of that has a man with a very strong London accent yelling over the barricades at the guy once he's already on the ground, "You ain't Muslim, bruv, you ain't Muslim." Which I, on the one hand, the cynic in me kind of is a little skeptical of that. But on the other hand, I actually think that's quite lovely. You know, we talked about coolness on the last podcast and needing to remain open to being moved by things like that. And I thought that was quite lovely that was someone's response to that, to denounce it on the spot. Because a lot of people, often people who support Donald Trump, will say, well, why don't the Muslims rise up and denounce this? Stephen Bizet, I think his name is, has argued that for Muslims, silence is consent, and so by not explicitly opposing it, they are consenting to it. And so I thought it was quite lovely that someone actually stood up and opposed it directly to the guy's face.
Provided that guy was Muslim, I'll agree with you.
Well, it wasn't quite.
If the guy is just some Londoner who's not Muslim, who's telling this Muslim that
right.
he's not Muslim, then, yeah, that loses.
That was something that I liked on... You had posted this... The thing that you've seen do the rounds, or the kind of the Monty ISIS as Monty Python. You know, I'm doing Islamic terrorism. No, you're not. What? What do you mean, no, I'm not? That piece, right? And...
Yeah, that was actually... That was actually by a journalist, if I remember correctly.
I think it was by a friend of the journalist. The journalist had clarified that he didn't write it, he was just passing it along.
Posting it.
But it was a very amusing Monty Python kind of skit about an ISIS terrorist trying to explain to a Western liberal that actually they are doing this in the name of Islam, and the liberal explained to them that, no, you're not, you don't understand what you're doing. You're just oppressed by us. And,
and then going on to apologize for the oppression.
But what this stirred up in me was the thought that it seems odd that the left behaves with regard to ISIS in a way that is incompatible with the way that they behave toward everything else. In any other context, if a 16-year-old boy said that he self-identified as a girl, or a middle-aged man self-identified as a teenage boy, then the left would be all over that. It's like, yeah, absolutely, how dare you, you bigot, how dare you say that this teenage boy isn't actually a teenage girl? If he says he's a teenage girl, then, you know, who are we to say otherwise? But if you do accept ISIS's self-identification as Islamic, then you're a bigot for that too. And I also find it interesting that they ordinarily fetishize intellectual qualifications. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, who are you to dispute these dozen climate scientists who say that global warming is taking place and you just aren't qualified? Well, the guy who leads the Islamic State has a doctorate in Islamic studies. Where's their doctorate in Islamic studies to say otherwise? And so, you know, it seems at war with the way that they handle every other issue.
It's because self-identification is always good. And so, you know, a boy that identifies as a girl, a 58-year-old man that identifies as a 12-year-old girl, that has to be good. That's always good. But because the Islamic State is so clearly bad, then it must be a false self-identification.
False consciousness.
Exactly. Yeah.
So why is it not false consciousness for the 58-year-old man to self-identify as the prepubescent girl?
Because it's good. Because he's happy. And if he's happy, then that's good. That's the ultimate.
What if the jihadis are pretty happy?
Us to be happy. Well,
they're going directly to heaven to get their 72 Virginians.
Yep, exactly. But they're making other people unhappy.
Mm. So is the problem with the transgender thing simply that we've not made sufficiently clear that we're unhappy?
Well, we're unhappy for the wrong reason.
Oh.
Yeah.
God, it's a bit like being in a minefield, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. You can just feel that circular logic just take you over. So, speaking of the Muslims and ISIS and all that good stuff, a recent survey came out that said 44% of the United States favors keeping a database of the names of Muslims. 60% of Republicans favor that. What's going on with their country? Is this a giant concern?
The first thing to say about that and similar polling numbers with regards to Trump and immigration is that whatever else you can say about it, it is no longer a fringe position.
Mm-hmm.
You can't dismiss it as extremist anymore, because if extremist is not measured against the mean of the country, then it loses all meaning. And what else can it be measured against instead? I mean, if someone has something else to bring forward and they say, well, he's an extremist relative to this other thing that we can agree on, fair enough. But I think, by and large, when we use those terms, we mean outside of the mainstream. And if these proposals are wrong, then they are at least wrong with the backing of the mainstream. That this is no longer considered an unthinkable thought. I don't know that I agree that it's unconstitutional, although I think it's probably a bad idea to do a registration. There was a thing on Catholic Memes, I think it was, that said that the best way to approach these kinds of questions is replace the word Muslim or whatever word with the word Catholic and see whether you still agree with the policy. I wouldn't necessarily say it was unconstitutional for the government to have a registry of all the Catholics in America or all the guns in America, if you want to talk about the Second Amendment. I don't think that registration is itself a violation of the Constitution. If you stipulate, for example, that the census is constitutional, I wouldn't object to it being mandatory to answer the question about religion in a constitutional sense. I don't think it's good policy. I think that it's just going to inflame tensions and create difficulties, but it's not as far outside of the of the realm of the conceivable, as I think some people seem to assume it is. I'm not sure that I agree that just to say that something is done that could ultimately become a pretext for something that would be much worse, and that could ultimately be a pretext for something that is unconstitutional, that it's necessarily against the rules. As I want to be very clear, I don't support the policy, but I'm not sure that it would violate the Constitution.
I think it would violate the Constitution. Interestingly enough, I think the place that it would most clearly violate the Constitution is under the rather amorphous right to privacy idea. I know.
Well, see, I don't believe that there is a general free-floating constitutional right to privacy, so there's the difference.
Considering that it's already in the jurisprudence, I'll go ahead and use it. if it's there, no court's going to strike down the right to privacy. I don't see that happening.
No, but they might refuse to extend it.
They might refuse to extend it. They might reinterpret it.
I should point out, because the viewers can't see it, but I'm wearing a T-shirt with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas.
Yes,
and so I, this is not the right day to try and sell me on the right to privacy.
But, you know, like...
It's starting to burn. I can...
Yeah, unlike other things that we keep databases of. We keep databases of licensed drivers. We keep databases of teachers, of professionals, all sorts of stuff.
We keep databases of all citizens, right? This is what the census does. We just don't attach names to it,
well,
as far as we know.
That's the thing, is that you don't attach names to it. And the entire reason why the census is mandatory is to appropriate representatives. No other reason. And so,
well, that's why it exists.
Yes.
It's not the only thing. It's not the only use to which the data is put.
Correct. Like, that's the entire reason why it's one of those things that's listed in the Constitution, and that you can get in trouble for not at least answering, yes, I live here, and this is how many people are in my household. But for something like keeping a database of names of everyone who is of a particular religious persuasion, especially on the federal level, that's just a bridge too far. This is something that's, you know, religious persuasion is protected, and this is an extra step that we're taking to target a specific group.
But again, this is why I bring up the guns analogy. And I know that there are people who oppose firearms registration and say that they don't put it like this, but I'm assuming that what they have in mind is something like an overbreadth analysis. A registration of firearms allows a future government to very easily find all of those firearms and take them away. And taking them away is unconstitutional. Therefore, registering them must also be unconstitutional. I don't buy that necessarily. And again, I want to underscore, I think it's a terrible idea, because the result is inevitably going to be estrangement, division, and radicalization. But I don't know that it's quite clear to me that it's an unconstitutional thing to do.
To flip it, under what provision would you say the federal government has the power to collect the names of every Muslim in the United States?
That's a much better question. I mean, that's exactly the question to ask. There are two inquiries always. Does the federal government... Has it been given the power to do this in the first place? And second, is that power constrained by any particular right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that, of course, is why there were people who said that the Bill of Rights isn't necessary. The government has no power to regulate the press. Therefore, why would we need to have a right of the press? And so I don't know, but my guess is that the way that you would do it would be under border control, which is an implied power, but it's one that has been recognized for a very long time. So, for example, there is the so-called border search exception under Ramsey that gives the government very broad power to basically ignore the Fourth Amendment at the border, because control of the border is a quintessential national function. this is something that the national government must be able to do, not because the Constitution says so, but because it creates a national government, and that's an inherent attribute of a national government.
I could see as constitutional keeping a list of every Muslim who enters and exits the United States. But there's a leap from that to registering every Muslim who is within the United States. I don't see that as...
Yes, and one might ask the question why we do not already keep a registry of everyone who enters and leaves the country. You know, part of the problem is... and this goes to the watering down of the word racism that we talked about before. Mm-hmm. When people say, when people object to Trump's immigration comments and say, well, he's a racist,
mm-hmm.
what that says to me is, you're stupid. You know, you don't understand either what Islam is or what the word race means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Islam is a religion. There are white Muslims, there are black Muslims, there are Middle Eastern Muslims, there are Sumatran Muslims. It's an idea. It's a religious affiliation. It's not a race. And so how would you know? It's not on their passport. It usually doesn't say this person's a Muslim. And so how would you even implement it on a practical basis? You're going to ask them? Well, of course, the people who mean you harm are going to lie.
You could just ask them to... to the Shahada.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
The Shahada, the profession of faith required to become a Muslim.
Okay.
And any good Muslim should be able to recite the Shahada.
Well, but... So how would this test... Well, the test is, if they're able to do so, then they must be a Muslim?
If they're willing to do so. Meaning I could recite the Shahada, but I won't. Whereas a Muslim would probably be quite comfortable reciting the Shahada.
Except the ones who are coming in to cause a problem, which defeats the whole point of the exercise.
There you go.
Which, again, is why it's bad, or one reason why it's bad policy, because it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it would be a waste of time. I completely agree with you on that point. We could create a policy. Right? There's enough ways of gathering information that we could create a policy. It would just be a really bad one.
Yeah, I don't... on the one hand, I kind of understand the frustration that people feel, that what Trump is suggesting is not a stupid thought. It's not an unintelligent reaction to say, we have people coming here trying to harm us, maybe we should consider keeping them out. And there is no way to effectively do a background check that will keep out only the ones who are a problem, so maybe we need to cast a broader net. As a first response to the problem, that's not an illogical move. But they are being told by the New York Times, the White House, and people like that, that that is not only stupid, but racist and all that kind of stuff. And so they're doubling down on it. And instead of the conversation which we ought to have, which is that suggestion gets made, and it's explained, well, that won't work because... yada yada yada, it raises constitutional problems and yada yada yada, and treating it like it is a serious idea that then gets rejected and then we move on to something else, they get stuck on the original response because they're being told you're not allowed to think that thought, and then they get so mad that they're being told that you're not allowed to think that thought that they don't proceed, they get stuck on it rather than proceeding through essentially the kind of conversation that we've just had of why it wouldn't work.
Right. And one would think that progressives would be well positioned to understand that, right? Because they tend to be very sympathetic to people who have been indoctrinated to believe particular beliefs without ever being allowed to be exposed to other beliefs, to hear other arguments for other positions.
Right?
To work through those arguments and come to their own conclusions. It's just all very convenient that understanding doesn't occur on these kinds of issues.
It's a special exemption.
Yeah. So speaking of special cases, I was hoping we could move on to a more Christmassy topic about a special case, which is the incarnation. I've been doing some thinking about it lately, and I'm working on some writing about it as well. and trying to figure out what makes the Christian incarnation unique. I was wondering if y'all had any thoughts on that.
I think one of the things that might make it unique is the nature of God and the Christian understanding, especially compared to if you look at other, look at more, some of the more pantheistic examples, like out of Egypt, things like that. The gods aren't necessarily as all-powerful as the triune goddess. And so this idea of this being who is outside of the universe, who maintains the universe, coming into the universe, taking on flesh, being fully part of the universe, but at the same time fully outside of the universe, is substantially different from examples of other religions, especially within the region where you had gods who were, seemed to be more a part of the universe, coming down and becoming a mortal or taking on the form of a mortal.
Yeah, so not like a Zeus.
Yeah, not like a Zeus or, you know, or the gods like Hercules or anything like that.
What other examples are there in other religions where you have not a god becoming manifest in the way you're talking about, but actually becoming one of us, one of us, one of us? I mean, are there other instances where you have, in the most literal possible sense of the word, the most restrictive sense of the word, an incarnation of a god? Forget the pantheism piece. What kind of examples do they look like?
Well, you can have the Rastafarian example, where they believe that their emperor was an incarnation of God.
Okay.
And that was actually very similar to the Egyptian example that you invoked, where they believed that certain pharaohs were an incarnation of a deity.
Yeah.
A sort of interesting combination.
Within their lifespan or afterward?
Both.
Yes.
And that's kind of an interesting combination of an existing religion and a political cult. You don't see that a lot nowadays. You know, that's something that tends to have an older genesis, which makes the Rastafarian example even more unusual.
What time frame is that?
Within the last couple of centuries, I think.
The emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, something like that. Haile Selassie. He fought the Italians. Within the 20th,
unsuccessfully of history. My history is right.
Within the 20th century.
Oh wow! Okay, yes. So very recently. Are there? I mean, it's not strictly within your Christmas theme, but are there examples of a god coming and taking on flesh and not being a political leader and not rising to prominence and worldly success, for want of a better term? Is that one of the things that we might distinguish it on?
We could. I can think of a number of avatars of Vishnu. But if I'm remembering correctly, almost all of them had some sort of prominent heroic task that they accomplished within the existing political order. I'd have to check the list of avatars of Vishnu. Well, I would have to check both lists because there are multiple lists.
So there probably are not a large number of prominent examples where even within a polytheistic pantheon, a god has taken on flesh, and I mean, I'm trying to talk around that kind of hippy dippy. He came to serve business, but that's really what I'm trying to get at. That there are not many examples you know this stuff much better than I do, and you're reaching, you're having to reach pretty far into the trick bag to pull out any examples, where you have a god takes on flesh, and essentially becomes an itinerant preacher for the public part of his life. Spends a lot of his life in obscurity, and then becomes a public preacher. Even setting aside how to characterize the culmination of that, because one can characterize what was done on the cross either as, in worldly terms, bitter defeat, or I forget what the term you use for the avatar of Vishnu, but as a mighty work, depending on how you. On the mm-hmm. time frame in which you want to perceive it.
Yeah, the only example I can think of is the Buddha, in that case. The Buddha, in some lists, is considered the ninth avatar of Vishnu. And so you'd have a similar case where, after a fairly normal life initially, he became the sort of ascetic who retreated from the world and studied under these other ascetics, and then eventually became a public preacher. That's the closest analog I can think of.
Would Buddhist consider Buddha the ninth avatar of Vishnu?
I don't know of any Buddhists who would consider the Buddha the ninth avatar of Vishnu, but in certain Hindu circles, that is something that's taken seriously.
Would the American preacher who went over there that you had posted the article about
to Ceylon?
Sounds right. There was an article in First Things this week about an American preacher in, I think, the 1880s who went over there and systematized Buddhism in a certain sense.
He created a Buddhist catechism.
Right, and precisely because he's coming from a Christian background and is thus going to wheel in a lot of Christian precepts, maybe he would have been sympathetic to that idea. Or possibly even less sympathetic, I don't know. It seems... as converts, we do tend to carry our biases in.
We do. I think in his case, that his bias would lead to him more imposing his existing views on the religion as he found it, rather than him exploring counterexamples and then saying, how does this fit into my understanding of Buddhism?
Sure, but that's what I'm driving at, that if he encounters this idea of the Buddha as an incarnational being, let's put it that way, then the cognitive biases he brings in coming from an incarnational religion are probably going to bias him to either be significantly more or less sympathetic to that than someone who has not really had that kind of background. And so it's unlikely that he's going to take no position on it. I could see people coming out either way on that point. I know of no Protestant converts who are just kind of on the Marian stuff, for example. They tend to go one or two ways. They get very heavily into it, or they continue to find it kind of icky and embarrassing. And that kind of biasing I could see would lead him, if he encountered it, I didn't know that he would have actually encountered it, to take a much more decisive attitude towards it than perhaps the people who just grew up being aware of that and didn't really consider it important enough to make a decision either way. Or maybe I'm crazy.
No, I think that's true. If he encountered the idea, he would have had a strong reaction to it.
I don't think he encountered it given where he was operating out of.
Probably
he
not.
Was in the Philippines, I think, and you're talking, this is an Indian idea.
He was in...
Sri Lanka?
Yeah, Sri Lanka. Yeah, and that's primarily Buddhist. And so it's a Hindu idea that Buddha was an avatar. So I don't think he would have encountered the idea necessarily.
So maybe that's the answer, well, that's part of the answer, that not only is it rare... to have a... Not only is monotheism rare in the first place, but monotheism with an incarnational aspect is pretty rare, and indeed an incarnational aspect even with polytheism is relatively rare. And so you don't have an awful lot of other examples. And I think that your original question was what makes it special and what makes it different, mm-hmm. that it is, in the very least, a sufficiently outlandish claim. You know, a lot of Christianity's claims, you know, this Lewis dealt with this very effectively. A lot of what we believe is so kooky that either we're nuts or it is. You know, just nutty enough to be true.
Yeah, the only example I would have against that would be the Emperor Selassie example. And it's difficult to make the claim that they're equivalent precisely because it was pretty clear that Jesus didn't come to establish a new political mm-hmm. order.
Yeah.
That he wasn't primarily a political figure, whereas in the case of the emperor, that was part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was...
Yeah, if you want to establish a political regime, then claiming to be God incarnate isn't a bad move. I'm surprised Mussolini didn't try it, just to close that loop. And he may have, for all I know.
The interesting two things about one is that the religion was founded, you know, after Christianity. It was clearly influenced.
Strongly influenced, yes.
And two, the emperor himself never explicitly made the claim that he was an incarnation of God. He kind of he fostered it. He winked, winked, nudged, and he was really happy whenever he...
My people, I am not saying that I'm not God.
Yeah. It was a very odd circumstance. You know, he was actually Ethiopian Orthodox. And he never left the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. He never tried to impose that religion. It was kind of these people heard of him and thought he was very, very interesting and decided, you know what, he's such a savior of his people that he must be the savior of his people. You know, he must be God. So, yeah, it's a very interesting religion. But, yeah, in the
incarnation... The true Messiah would deny he's the Messiah.
Exactly. In the incarnation of Christianity, it seems that it takes several elements. You'll find different elements elsewhere. You'll find sacrificial gods in other religions. You'll find gods come down to earth in other religions. You'll find virgin births.
Right, and that's why I was wanting to underscore incarnation rather than just presence.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of cases of that.
Yes.
You'll even find infancy narratives in other religions.
But within Christianity, it's together in such a way that you don't find elsewhere. And it's very unusual, because one of the things, you know, with the Hindu examples, with the avatars of Vishnu, the entire idea of the Hindu religion is to support their society. The Hindu religion is designed to reinforce the political structures that they have in place. Christianity isn't like that. In many ways, Jesus came and said things while not explicitly trying to be a political leader. He said things that were to turn up on its head the prejudices and the political organization of its day.
Yeah, he seemed to suggest that that religion ought to transcend politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I can't think of a... I see what point you're making, but...
Which is, by the way, is not to say that it would abolish politics.
Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, mm-hmm. but unto God what is God.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to think of a way to express it, but the way that I would read that and think about that is not that religion is outside of politics, expressing in terms of a metaphor where you have layers of clothing, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The religion is the overcoat and the politics is the undershirt. Mm-hmm. But more that politics is the undershirt and religion is a warm summer's day. I mean, it's just incomparable things that aren't even so much running on different tracks as they are different things that operate in the same space, but that are not really connected in that way. I mean, obviously politics does have a lot to do with religion. Whenever we talk about what benefits does a policy have for society, I mean, I don't know how you could have that conversation without having some shared notion of the term good, and that is going to be inevitably decided by your religious views. What is good for society?
Your analogy is rather strange.
I know, I'm not doing well coming up with a good analogy.
But I kind of like it. Because, you know, if you take a look at the religion, you know, the religious tradition that Jesus came out of, you know, the Jewish faith is totally linked up with the idea of the Jewish nation. You can't separate the two. But Christianity comes along and says it doesn't matter what nation you're part of. You shouldn't necessarily seek out to make your nation the greatest nation there is, or your family the greatest family there is, because there's something that's totally beyond that. You know, one of the things that's beautiful about Christianity is especially emphasized in the early church, that it doesn't matter your station of life, what government, you know, it doesn't matter whose rule you're under, that you can be a faithful Christian no matter if you're free or slave. You can be a faithful Christian if you're being oppressed by the state, or if you're not being oppressed by the state. There's ways to be faithful Christians in virtually any circumstance. And, you know, that's what's so revolutionary. One of the things that's so revolutionary about Christianity is that it gives us a way to live in any circumstance, rather than forcing us to meld the world to just one particular circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked before off mic about even when you start thinking about an issue where quintessentially people think of religion and politics as intersecting, such as abortion. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that everyone will agree with me on this, but it does not seem to me that a Catholic must believe that abortion must be illegal. What they must believe is that it's murder. That doesn't mean that a Christian, or that a Catholic rather, necessarily needs to believe that murder should be criminal. You could be a radical libertarian Catholic and take the view that the only way that actions can be virtuous or vicious is if you are free to make them without the state compelling you, and so we wanted to have a very libertarian society in which there are no criminal laws, there are simply torts, and so if you kill someone, you're going to get sued. But the point where religion intersects with it is in the classification. It's rejecting the idea that you can say that murder in utero is any different from murder extra utero. Even on that kind of hot button topic, there's not necessarily a Christian answer to what should the state look like.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Ish.
Ish.
You're more skeptical of this libertarian point than I think Sam is. I think when we've talked about this before.
Yes. Just going by, from what I understand, the church teaches the obligation of government. The church seems to reject that radical notion of government, that there are certain obligations that government has to meet. Now, you could. I don't know if we're compelled to agree with the church on all of those things. It's one of those rather mushy areas, but you know, we are required to definitely consider it.
I think that when you're talking about the social teaching, which has existed for less than 0.5 of the church's percent of the church's existence,
something like it is just for the government to punish murder.
Mm-hmm.
goes back.
Oh yeah, it's just for the government to punishment. So okay, so I wasn't going to bring this up because we're kind of running a little late, but that's what editing is for. So there was an article in the Distributist Review. God bless Reddit. You know, it makes you know. I get exposed to so many interesting things.
I had no idea there was a Distributist Review.
There's a Distributist Review, yeah. The author was making a similar argument to the one that you're making, and my response, and we'll just start with what you said, is it's just for the state to punish murder, but that does not necessarily mean that it is necessary for the state to punish murder. There are two different things going on here, and the problem that I had with this article is it's making the case that, look, Catholics should be less skeptical of the state than in America conservatives and libertarians tend to be, because the church has always held that the state has certain natural functions and can be a force for good in the world and all that kind of stuff. And my answer to that is, well, yes, it can be, but it can also not be. Washington said that the state is, what is it, dangerous servant and a fearful master.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that if you lack the power to make it a servant, your choices are you can banish it or you can be mastered by it. And in a bygone era when we had the power to domesticate government and to make use of it to accomplish moral ends that Catholics might approve, then that was one thing. But in a new reality in which we don't have that kind of power, then we have to start asking questions about, is it still, even though the state could do this, and it would be morally valid and licit and even laudatory for the state to do this, to do X in my habitual terminology, in a situation where it is instead going to be used to do Y, which is not in any way a good thing, should we not say that it has the power to do, that it shouldn't do either? And so the example that I suggested was attaching tax benefits to marriage.
Mm-hmm.
In a previous era, when everyone agreed on the traditional definition of marriage, it might have been a wise thing for the government to subsidize, to induce people to marry by offering tax benefits. That might have been a morally laudatory thing. I think that you know, you would never find any pope or bishop saying, oh no, the state shouldn't incentivize marriage by giving tax benefits. And so in that sense, you could say that the church has always accepted that that's a morally good thing for the state to do. But in a world in which we can no longer offer those benefits just to that restrictive traditional definition of marriage, where in reality it is going to be offered to, I was going to say other couples, but we can't even say that. I mean, you know, to other groups of people who claim some kind of amorous relationship, that the church does not recognize, it seems to me that the right answer is to say that the state should get out of that business entirely, even though it was perfectly good for it to do it in a previous situation. The world has changed, and so it's, you know, it just seems naive to my mind to say, oh well, the church has always had a fairly warm attitude towards the state, after a century in which we have had demonstrated quite vividly what the state can do when it goes awry. You know, not to say that we're all libertarians now, I think you have to be cognizant of the lesson that the last century teaches, which is that when the state, even though the state can be an instrument for good when it's in the right hands, it won't always be in the right hands. And so the question becomes, should you bind it down with onerous rules like the Commerce Clause and the First Amendment?
Yeah, I'm definitely sympathetic to that argument. I think that the state should always work towards justice, but if it becomes a point where if it hears that in its pursuit of justice, it's going to cause a greater injustice, then it should do neither. But it's very difficult to imagine a circumstance where the prosecution of murders, the criminalization of murder, of, you know, robbery, rape, those sorts of things, those things cause greater injustice than not going after them criminally. And so, you know, that's my one thing, is that this is such a basic form of justice, going after these basic crimes, that in almost every circumstance, it's better to allow the state to pursue justice in those situations rather than have the state have it legal. I have a lot of trouble imagining a scenario where the prosecution of murders cause more trouble than just letting it alone.
As you're actually the libertarian in the room, you should have some thoughts on this.
Well, I do have a question, and I don't have an answer to this question. Mm-hmm. My question is, do we know what sort of justice will be obtained by moving to a tort-only kind of system? And how that would compare to what the state currently does?
One of the things it would do is it would put the... I want to be very clear, I'm not advocating for this system. I feel like I'm having to do a lot of hedging in this podcast. This is the devil's advocate episode. One of the things it would do is it would remove the state as a third party that decides when legal action is pursued against someone who kills someone, because it would be then in the hands of the victim, the victim's relatives, the victim's estate, and so forth. And so I'll give you the example that's hardest for me, or that cuts most strongly against that case for me, where you have consensual murder. If you have a situation where someone euthanizes a parent or wants to be killed in some kind of kinky sex game, as I think happened in Germany, wasn't there a guy who wanted to be cannibalized? He wanted to be killed and eaten. There may exist full consent between the killer and the killed, and let's stipulate for sake of argument that the families are all, you know, who am I to judge, very airy-fairy people. In such circumstances, under the current situation, the state might have a very different view and prosecute for murder anyway, even if all of the people who were parties to the activity were fully consenting and fully happy with the event, with what was done. That would not stop the state from coming in and prosecuting them, and there are good reasons why the state might want to do that. You know, apart from deterrence, it's, you know, this is an injury against the community. But in a purely private system, then that would not be prosecuted if the family completely agreed with it. You would privatize the notion of when justice needs to be applied in the first place. You know, I don't think that that's a good idea, but if that's the answer to your question, that's what it would do, or that's one of the things that it would do.
And beyond that, I mean, the only way I could see the situation working at all is if involuntary servitude was brought back as something that could be a judgment in that sort of court case. Because let's say you're a poor family and some other poor person killed your relative. What's the point of bringing a court case against them if they have no assets?
Right.
So, you know, you have these roving bands of impoverished killers, and they have no money. The court system is completely ineffective against them unless you can force them to work off their debt. And in a system that doesn't allow that, then we're down to vigilante justice.
Right. The social contract starts to fray.
Exactly.
But that's a charge that's commonly made against some of the more extreme libertarian proposals anyway.
Yes.
The state is kind of a lubricant within the social contract. You probably have more.
No, I honestly haven't thought too much about it because it's not a position I take.
Mm-hmm.
But I was kind of curious just to see what y'all would think about it.
Yeah, I think it's a dangerous... I mean, I use that solely to illustrate the point that you can imagine a version of... To agree, essentially, with Mike, that there is not a single configuration of the state that is required by Christianity. That Christianity can never be quite co-identified with the state in the way that Judaism was with the Jewish nation.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Bring it all the way. Yeah.
I rise today in support of my learned colleague.
Yeah, I guess what it does do is narrow your range of options.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't be... You can't be communist.
I wanted to come back, and maybe we'll close on this because it's getting a little late, to the Buddhist article. And I want to get this quote right, so I've got a note of it. So, our friend, whose name is again escaping me, even though you mentioned it earlier, who went and wrote this Buddhist catechism. The line is, he attacked the Buddhist practice of veneration and made the distinctly Western claim that the essence of Buddhism did not lie in the rituals of the Buddhist monks, but in the philosophy and texts of Buddhism, a kind of sacred scripture. Now, my question for you, and I know I posed this before, and I didn't like your answer, so I hope to provoke a different answer, was whether or not that claim is correct. Why is it distinctly Western? And your answer previously was... This was a very Sam response.
Yes, it was.
Well, can you think of any counterexamples, any other examples? I can't, and I understand the point you're making, but why is it a distinctly Western idea that the essence of a, let's just use the R word and say religion, that it lies in the rituals rather than in the ideas and the texts, if I can put it that way? Or would you agree with that? I mean, is that...
I don't know that I would agree with that, simply because I don't have all the information about every religion that has ever existed in the East and West. but I would say that I don't have any evidence that that's not the case, that I can't find any counterexamples to that. I can't find anything in the East where you have a major religious tradition that is tied to a specific textual... body, and exclusively draws upon that textual body and has chosen to stop venerating of any sort or kind in pursuit of some sort of religious purity.
Is it
veneration is widely accepted in the East?
It seems puzzling to me. I understand that you can have religions in which orthodoxy is the dominant concern over orthopraxy, and vice versa. And even within Catholicism, there are strands that are more concerned with orthopraxy than orthodoxy. I've seen various things recently that have insisted that Islam is a religion that is much more concerned with orthopraxy than orthodoxy. And so I understand the idea that practice, you know, ritual and practice and stuff that is done in a certain sense competes with ideas in terms of their relative importance in many religions. But I find it very hard to understand how any religion could not essentially orbit an idea or a claim about the world that might be, for example, written down, but not necessarily. It could be an oral tradition.
But fundamentally,
you know, the ideas are what the practice are in service of to. And it's hard for me to imagine that not being, which
I'm
probably goes
sure
back
about
to
that.
Yeah.
I think it's complicated to discern whether an idea is in service of a practice or whether the practice is in service of the idea.
I think this goes back to some of my cognitive biases that we've talked about before. I mean, in terms of the way that the certainly you and I, and I think the three of us, approach religion when we talk about the Anglican piece, and you know, are we even asking the same questions? But certainly, to my mind, I would think that religion has to start with an idea or a claim that then organizes the practice. And so, for example, if you are meditating, that might be a practice, and it may be a very useful practice, but to what end are you meditating is framed by, at very least, by the substantive content of the religion. Maybe that's the word I should be using. Mm-hmm. Substantive rather than...
I think that's true. I also think you're asking a chicken and egg question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an anthropological question, and it's one that's difficult to have an answer to, but I'm more inclined to think actions come, and then we figure out why we're doing that. It appears that in ancient societies, we first have these places where people offered stuff to. It's an action where we have these altars. We have these places where people bring stuff to offer things to. Before we have any written language, before the existence of cities, we have places to offer sacrifice. And so we could call it an idea, but it's not a very well-formed idea.
Surely that the idea of offering a sacrifice on an altar is necessarily preceded by the idea that there is some utility to the sacrifice and something to which the sacrifice is being offered, whether divine or otherwise. Because otherwise, why are they even doing it?
Mm-hmm.
Although I suppose I could imagine in pre-communication civilizations, you're doing it because you're learning by example, because your parent did that. And so maybe, it's simply something that people have done for forever, mm-hmm. and has been elaborated on and explicated as down the line.
But I think, because it seems to be, once again, size of the same coin. That you have this basic concept and the human response is to do something. You have concepts and response, and they feed into each other. But what you kind of notice in what Sam said is in the Western response to that, and it's not completely true across all Western traditions, but there's this certain subset that says, okay, we need to take the idea and put that over here, and we're just going to talk about the idea. We're not going to have the response, because we have the Protestants started to get hang-ups on the responses. And then even off of that, you have, secular traditions, where it's like, well, we have all of these things that are involving religious, but we just need to talk about ideas. And it's a very Western concept. I kind of wonder if it's born out of the Greek understanding and separating, because the Greeks separated the body from the soul. And for the Greeks, these are two separate ideas, the idea that we had this pure form of the soul and this physical body. Whereas the Hebrews, body and soul weren't separate. They were linked. And so I think this Greek error, in many ways, this Greek error of body and soul being separate kind of keeps on leaking into Western thought. And the idea that our ideas, our concepts, are more important than the actions that we do.
Yeah, or that... our ideas can be imposed upon reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has been great for us technologically, not so great for us philosophically.
Yes.
I think a healthy relationship between ideas and our lived reality is that we learn from our lived reality, which shapes our ideas, and then our ideas are coming out of that lived reality rather than something we try to pull from outside of that lived reality and then impose on it. And there should be a relationship of mutuality there.